Good to see everybody here this evening. We want to talk on a subject tonight that was actually a question, not in our box here. Mike has asked me if I could do tonight because that last question he's going to deal with is a doozy. It's a good question, mind you. It's a great question. But I had the mindset after I read it, looking at that question, I looked at Mike and I said, better you than me to answer that one. I would have taken it push come to shove, but it would have been a big push and a big shove for me to take that one. It's a good question, but it's tough. And he said he needed some extra time anyway on it because his schedule has been so busy here lately that he hasn't been able to devote quite as much time maybe to it as he ordinarily would have. The question that was raised to me was probably presented to me, I'm going to say roughly 2005, 2006. It was one of those questions that I answered when I was in Taylor, when we were having our question and answer series. Somebody came and asked me about this thing called moral relativism. And a lot of you may not have heard it, and some of you may have heard it, okay? And what we're going to be talking about this evening is this mindset, this philosophy, if you will, that basically says all morals, all ethics are really up to you. Everything is up to you. The word morals that we have today is the distinction between right and wrong. It's the principles of right and wrong in conduct and in ethics. That's what the word morals means. The word relativism is the philosophy which maintains that all basis of judgment is relative. And we'll talk about that word here in just a second. It's relative, differing according to events, persons, circumstances, situation, and in some cases, even geography, where you live in the world. Now, let's put those two together. Translated, moral relativism says that what constitutes morality, that is, what's right and wrong, and what constitutes ethics, that code of conduct, that is how we live in how we conduct ourselves in society, really and truly is a matter of individual preference based upon your own situation, your own circumstances, your own personal standard of right and wrong. Now, let's go back to the word relativism because it talks about that all basis of judgment is relative. Now, what does that mean? Now, we're not talking about your relatives, your familial relatives. You're not talking about your Uncle Fred and your Aunt Josie or whatever. Not talking about your cousins and stuff like that. The word relative here, as they will use that terminology, they use it as an adjective. In fact, you look up in the dictionary and you'll find it there. It means literally from the concept of not absolute. Nothing is absolute. So basically what they're saying in their belief in this doctrine that is out there is that nothing is absolute. Nothing of right and wrong nature is absolute. Now go back to what we were talking about relativism. Circumstances, situations, geography, persons, events, you name it, can all shape what we're seeing today in our society in your decisions. And I wanted to go back and revisit. I almost wish I could go back to Taylor and revisit this one again. Because we're starting to see the fruition of that mindset. Stop and think for just a moment. We've gotten to the point in our society where we came up with expressions, my truth and your truth. And there, in other words, we'll just use this as an example here, okay? Brian can say, well, but this is my truth on this subject. And I can say, well, this is my truth on this subject. And neither one of them have anything to do with each other. My truth is totally different than his truth. And you could take that on a variety of subjects out there. And it's not just this issue, by the way, of my truth and your truth and stuff like that, but we're beginning to see this really permeate our society today in things like definitions don't matter anymore. Definitions don't make a bit of difference. We're just going to change the definition of something. Or we're going to make up things. Because after all, it's just kind of up to you what's right and wrong. It's up to me what's right and wrong. Things like gender fluidity, transgender, all these different terminologies that we have out there now. Well, today is true that I'm a man. Tomorrow, it might not be true that I'm a man. Why, with gender fluidity, tomorrow I can proclaim myself to be a woman. And by the way, and we'll talk about this here in more in just a moment, if you discuss this with somebody and say, well, that's ridiculous, you're going to be judged because of that. They're going to look at you like, well, you're just being judgmental. You just don't understand. And these different things that we're having begin to influence things, like we have men who are now being allowed to participate in women's sports and literally rob them of something they have worked their entire lives for. We're seeing that. And all of this is going to go back to this mindset that there is no objective standard of right and wrong in their minds. And don't you dare criticize them. Don't you dare tell them that what they're saying is not right. Now, having said all this, what we're talking about when we talk about moral relativism, here's an expression that I'm pretty sure all of us have heard. But folks, moral relativism is nothing more than a new name for an old sin. Do you hear the words, not so much anymore, but used to, situation ethics. Situation ethics. Well, situation ethics is, quote, the new, if you will, moral relativism. Where did we get this idea of situation ethics, or how did it become so popular in our world today? Well, many years ago when I was in school at Southwest, and I do mean many years ago, when I was at school at Southwest, I was assigned the topic, which at first I kind of cringed at a little bit, but the more I looked into it, the more I was going, I like that topic. I had to do a term paper on situation ethics. And it has come about over time that I've been able to use that very topic to deal with this, what we're dealing with today, moral relativism. A book came out in 1966 by an author by the name of Joseph Fletcher. Now, this is an old book here. The cover has gone through many changes, different looks. But this book right here was what gave me my beginning point into realizing how dangerous situation ethics really and truly is. How dangerous now, because you don't hear about situation ethics as much as you do the idea of moral relativism. And one of the things that you'll notice if you look at this book closely is it's called Situation Ethics, are you ready? The New Morality. Well, I'm going to tell you something. There's nothing moral about situation ethics. Absolutely nothing. I want to read just a couple. In fact, I've got a number of things marked here that we're going to read as we get into this. But this, just on the back cover, and this was what do you call those when they're writing about the particular book? The Westminster Press who produces this book, which, by the way, this is still in print. Their assessment of this book. Now listen to carefully what it says. Proclaiming that any moral system is too shallow and petty to provide answers, the author outlines a methodology for decision making which presupposes individual responsibility and declares that every man must decide for himself what is right. Well, folks, let me tell you something. What that boils down to is that he's saying we become our own gods. They have rejected God altogether. Now, this particular book, I didn't buy new. I don't know who this young lady was that had it before. What I do know about this is that some of the things that she wrote up, she became fully indoctrinated. Didn't take a whole lot of reading of her own notes. And I guess she took it to that used bookstore where I found it and sold it. And I bought it, if my memory serves me, probably about $1.50 or something like that. It's pretty inexpensive book. Now they cost about $30. But this book has been in colleges and universities and used as a basis. And actually, in fact, students had to purchase these books since 1966, and it's still in use. I'm presuming that it's still in use in colleges and universities. And if you don't have the book, if you were told to get the book so that you'd have it for a class, the professors are using the material of this book. And it's a dangerous, dangerous thing. And so you look at some of these things and stop and think for just a moment what's being said here. It presupposes individual responsibility and declares that every man must decide for himself what is right. Does that sound familiar? How about an Old Testament passage or two? Judges chapter 17 and verse 6. Judges chapter 21 and verse 25. There was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. You see, when you don't have a standard, then everybody gets to do what they want to do, believe what they want to believe, and act as though it is somehow the proper thing to do. Literally, since 1966, untold millions of people in this country, and maybe some others, I don't know, some other countries, have been taught this ungodly philosophy. And I'm going to suggest to you, because of what they were taught in school, it's probably found its way into many public schools today. Probably has. Last little thing I'm going to read on the back. The author, Joseph Fletcher, at the time of this, was now the professor of medical ethics. That's scary. Because now a doctor just gets to do what's right in his own eyes. Well, I just think it's a good thing for just let this person die, but there's a solution. We have medicine but that person's kind of old, and they're not very valuable to society anymore, so I just think I'll just let them die. I'm not going to administer the kind of surgery or the kind of medicines that will help them. It's just a dangerous thing, very dangerous. Let me just read a few before we get into book, chapter, and verse. We've already looked at a couple of them, but let me just read a couple of things here, a few things, and make some quick comments on it. This is under the idea, this is under a heading of principles, yes, but not rules. He writes in here that we might call it principled relativism. To repeat the term used above, principles or maxims or general rules are illuminators, but they are not directors. So any kind of principle that you come up with, anything that you come up with to direct you in your moral activities, you don't have a real directive for. Listen to this. Situation ethics, on the other hand, calls upon us to keep law in a subservient place, so that only love and reason really count when the chips are down. We've got a problem with that. We're going to discuss that here in just a moment. So what this really boils down to, when you look at some of these things, and I have this note in here myself, this is just putting lipstick on a pig. You still have a pig. I don't care if you put lipstick on it or not. It's still a pig. ultimately you can discard the principle that he talks about in principled relativism because it isn't founded in an objective truth. It's not founded in objective law. So you can discard your principles too. I tell you, this is a very, very dangerous thing that we have out there. There are too many, and I'm going to tell you right now, when I got this book, and I started having to read through it to do my term paper at school, I thought my brain was just going to fall out on the floor. It was so awful. Notice what he says here. Every man must decide for himself according to his own estimate of conditions and consequences. And no one can decide for him or impugn the decision to which he comes. See, what I was telling you just a moment ago is so true. Don't dare question them because you don't have a right to question the response or how they came to a conclusion or the quote, moral decision they came to. You don't have a right to do that. Perhaps this is the end of the matter after all. This is precisely what the book is intended to show. In other words, don't question me. I've made a decision, and I've made it based upon my standards. So don't dare question me. Does that sound familiar today? Don't question me. If you question me about my gender and my fluidity or whatever, well, you're just being unfairly just. You're being judgmental. Well, no, we're looking at what science tells us. We have XY chromosomes and XX chromosomes. One is a male, one is a female. And that's the end of the discussion. In the beginning, God made them male and female. It's not hard to understand. It's not difficult at all, honestly. But they want to make it that way very quickly. Here's something that we have to be careful about, pragmatism. The pragmatic approach. What does that basically say? That the end justifies the means. If it works, it must be right. Well, works to what end? We're going to have to ask questions like that. You can tell, and this is in her writing, the young lady that owned this book before me, for a decision we have to ask, who is to be helped rather than turning to law? We're going to ask, well, if I do this, this will help that person. What about what God's Word said? We don't care about that. And how about this? This is him writing this. The author. Coming full circle, once again, this writer now recognizes, but more maturely, well, how about an air of superiority there, that philosophy is utterly useless as a way to bridge the gap between doubt and faith. He goes on by saying, the circumstantial approach to the search for the right and the good is the way that you go about things. He will even try, brethren, to use the Bible in many places, which, by the way, I didn't read everything about this young man. He was formerly a professor of Christian social ethics. That ought to scare you to death. An Episcopal theological school at Cambridge, Massachusetts. That ought to scare you to death. Okay, but notice what he says here. This is the same temper, the very term, Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 12 when he says anything could be lawful. Whoa, 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 that's not what Paul was saying. He was saying all things are lawful for me, those things which are lawful for me. But not everything is expedient. Sometimes it may be lawful for me to do something, but it's more expedient to do this over here that is just as lawful. See, it's a dangerous thing that they go to. Here's a notation that I made. For anything to be expedient, it must first be lawful. You can't have something that's expedient that's not lawful. I'm not going to overwhelm us with too many of these quotes. I'm telling you, I have so many places marked up when I was reading it that I had to kind of pick and choose for this. Personalism, that falls under this general heading that he was under here about four working principles. One of them was pragmatism. We'll look at this one now. Personalism, and it's very arrogant, by the way, very arrogant approach to this. Ethics deals with human relations. Situation ethics puts people at the center of the concern, not things. Well, that's arrogant. If you're following God's law, if you're following the Word of God, you're putting people first. They really are. Now, they may not think by that. That means I have to change. Well, yes, you do. So did I. Obligation is to persons, he says, not to things, to subjects, not objects. The legalist is a what asker. Do you hear that? You're a legalist if you believe in law. And that it actually dictates to us, God's law dictates to us. The legalist is a what asker. What does the law say? Well, okay, if that's right, you want to define a legalist, I'm a legalist because I want to know what God has to say. That is, situationists are personalistic. Did I tell you about that arrogance? It's an air of arrogance here, without a doubt. In the Christian version, for example, a basic maxim is that the disciple is commanded to love people, not principles or laws or objects or anything else. Wait a minute. Didn't Jesus repeatedly appeal to the law? Time and time again, so he didn't put people first? No, actually, he came here for people. He came here to die on the cross for us. And you can see these in so many places here. Look at Old Testament concepts, Psalm 119, verse 97. Oh, how I love thy law. Thy precepts, I meditate upon them. Very quickly, let's move to another before we move into another section of the study that I'm wanting to talk about here. And by the way, I want your input. Don't get that hand up there where I can see it, and we'll address that. Here in a section called Love is the Only Norm, he has a subsection called Love Replaces the Law. The law is not subservient to love. And we're going to talk at length about that here in just a moment. I won't even read that one. It's too much involved in that right there. But he tries to use some Old Testament. In fact, he goes back to the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. This causes situation ethics no difficulty. Well, yes, it really does. Okay. He says for two obvious reasons. It is only a law in the sense that we can speak of the law of love or the law of one's being. Not a true commandment. Well, I wonder if you could go back in time in the days of Moses, when he came down off of Mount Sinai with those tablets in his hands, and this time he didn't have to break them. If the people were listening to that and thought, well, it's only a law in the sense that, really? I don't think so. I don't think that's how they would have approached this stuff. He says, now this is an interesting one here. Furthermore, one could surely pretend to have no faith in God or in any combination of gods if it were necessary for a loving cause. We could make a formal but false apostasy under persecution for the sake of dependence or the life of an illegal underground church. Do you know what he just said? You can lie through your teeth. That's what he's saying here. That's what they believe. And I'm telling you, this is all over, literally all over our nation right now, because of so many people who went to college and took these courses, and this is what we end up with. Yes?
It's actually being used still in universities as of 2018.
Do what now? Oh, okay. Mary said she just found it, and it is still being used in universities, at least as of 2016. 18. Look at the number of years. Look at the number of years that this kind of trash has been in the minds of our young people. Yes, ma'am. Good point.
It's not a matter of just me making a decision that you cannot question. Now I'm going to make the decision for you that you cannot question because I know what is best.
I think you just made a great point. If you didn't hear what Evelyn said, it's gone beyond just personal things because now those who posit themselves as being the supreme moralists nowadays were actually trying to tell us, well, we're going to decide for you what's right and wrong, and you don't have a right to question that. Jamie, did you have something?
Yeah. This is like something I've never studied in detail or the main definitions, but it's like something you know people do. They decide their own moral system. But I think it's really significant that this book was written, it was written in the 60s, right? People read it and people learned it and adapted it into their lives. I've never heard of this book before, but this book is bled through from their parents' generation. They watched their parents do it, and even if they don't know the name of it, they don't know that the situation like this. It's a learned behavior from the generation before them.
Yeah.
Because they see their parents stand for something morally, but they will cave when it benefits them.
Yes.
And so it's just so ingrained in our society that, it's very interesting to see that this is not even something new. This isn't even my generation. That's just, it's almost the American way.
Okay. I think that's an excellent point, because what's happened is it's been taught and taught and taught to the point where people just accept the fact that there is no objective moral standard of right and wrong. There's no absolute. Say what? Okay. Yeah. So. Okay. Good point. Now here's one, and I'm going to move off to that to something else very quickly. He brings up, and again, the law of Moses, the Ten Commandments, where it says, "Remember the Sabbath day; in it you shall do no work." Quote is of course completely overthrown by Christians who make Sunday the first day of the week the Lord's day. Well, Christian didn't do that; God did that. God made the first day of the week the day that we come together and we worship Him. He says, rather, the Old Testament Sabbath or seventh day is Saturday. Well, we're not under the old law. See, that's how wrong he is about so many different things. He goes on by saying we will have a lot of Sabbatarians who like to make the Lord's Day a day of gloom and doom, but few even pretend to obey this prohibition of Sunday work. Who could or would, in an independent society like ours, in which goods and services must be and should be produced on Saturdays and Sundays? And why not anyway? The situation, it says, not the better the day, the better the deed, but rather the better the deed, the better the day. Again, you see so much arrogance within this in this particular book. And again, I'm going to stop at that one right there. I've got more marked up that I could look at, and we'll look at least one more before it's over with. But let's talk about moral relativism versus God's law. We've already talked about some of the passages that are valuable to us from that standpoint. But first of all, let's understand something. Love is the basis for morality. Okay? But love has to have an objective standard for measurement. You see, the problem with our society is we've gone off into subjectivism. It's what I think, what I want, what I like, whatever suits me best, whatever I think is going to, the pragmatic approach, whatever's going to bring about the best result, what I think. The problem is that's not an objective standard. So what is the standard, or better yet, who is the standard? Because if we answer who the standard is, we're going to find out what the standard is. God is the standard. Somebody turn. I tell you what, let me just ask somebody so we're not spending a whole lot of time looking up things and waiting for somebody to say, Jaden, would you go to 1 John chapter 4, 8 through 9? And Peyton, would you mind going to Romans chapter 5 and verse 8? And Jaden, whenever you're ready.
He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. And this, the love of God was manifested toward us, that God has sent his only begotten Son into the world that we might live through him.
Okay. In the very first, as we would have it as sentences here, he who does not love does not know God, for God is love. God is love. We're beginning to understand the idea of who is that? Who is that standard, that objective standard, that measurement that says this is right, this is wrong? Remember, we're talking about, they're talking about, if you really love somebody, you can just kind of make up your own rules as you go along. But he goes on by saying, in this, the love of God is manifested toward. How? How do we know God is love? How do we know? Because he sent his only begotten Son to die on the cross that we can have hope of eternal life. That's how we know. That's how we know. Peyton, do you mind reading Romans chapter 5, verse 8 for me, please?
But God demonstrates his own love toward us, that while we're still sinners, Christ died for us.
Okay, so the very demonstration of God's law, as we saw just a moment ago, came from who? God. So when we see things like, for God is love, we're talking about something here that when we talk about God being the definition, he is not just the definition, he is the essence of love, he is the epitome of love. He's anything that you can think about, that's where love comes from, because he is, if I can use the term, he embodies love, because it is part of his eternal nature. You can't take that away from him. Second, the so-called new morality, as this book is titled, partially titled, says that love justifies our refusal to obey absolute rules of morality. So the absolute rules of morality, even if somebody should come along and say, well, you believe those, but you can disobey them if you want to. So in essence, there are no absolute objective moral standards. If you can just throw them out the window, you can throw those things out. But wait a minute, you just threw out God and you threw out his law. You threw out his rules. And in essence, when you stop and think about what this all involves, if you don't take God's inspired word for what it is, you can make up the rules as you go along. Whatever suits you, whatever fits the occasion, if you will. The situation, that's where the idea of situation ethics came from. Just situation changes, right and wrong changes. Situation changes, I can just go out and murder Raymond. Situation changed. No, I can't. That's immoral. How do I know it's immoral? God says murder is unlawful. It's unlawful. And again, if someone should suggest that there is absolute right and wrong, we don't have to follow that anyway, right? That's what he just said in his own book. The new morality says that laws governing morals and ethics are antiquated. Oh, they're so out of date. And only to serve, well, they make you feel guilty when, guess what? You shouldn't feel guilty at all. I mean, not even in the least should you feel guilty. Let me see if I can find something here really quickly. It's on the back cover. I didn't read this part. Oh, are you ready for this? This is a doozy. The sensational deductions which the author draws from this premise include the bold statement that any act, now I don't know what's so sensational about it, but they thought it was, that was their review, that was the word I was looking for just a moment ago, review. Now listen, any act, even lying, ready for this, premarital sex, abortion, adultery, and murder could be right. So Raymond, you're in trouble. If I was of a mindset like we have so many people out there today, and I had the mindset, well, circumstances and situations have changed, Raymond, you just need to die, I could justify myself in doing it. This is terrible stuff. And it's, as we've already talked about, it's permeating our society. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Okay. And so when you think of 1 John 5, verse 3, this is the love of God that we keep His commandments. And His commandments are not burdens.
Okay.
And so the things that God commands actually is for our benefit.
Yes.
And then Paul, by inspiration in 2 Thessalonians 2:15, will call them the traditions. The traditions that ought to be passed down from one to another.
Yes. Yeah, and I've often said this, and I genuinely believe you cannot find a single solitary commandment from God anywhere that is not for mankind's good. It's impossible. Now, you may not like it, and I say you in general, I'm talking about people in the world may not like what it says because it puts a prohibition on them from doing something they want to do. But it doesn't change the fact that what God gave us in His Word, in His law, His commandments are always for our well-being, every single time.
Royce, what Mike just said made me think that about that Ezekiel 13:22 passage about the lies that because of the lies of men has made the righteous sad.
Uh huh.
It applies here. I mean, it applies throughout all of us, but their situation, ethical approach, has caused for the righteous to be sad because of its growing and its persuasion on
me. Yes, because we have to live in this world, and we are surrounded by this kind of thing, and the righteous are striving to be, and not only be what God wants us to be from a moral objective standard, but to proclaim that truth to others. And it makes it challenging, makes it hard, doesn't it? Jamie. Yeah, he was a professor of Christian social ethics at an Episcopal theology school in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
He was a so-called priest.
Yeah, because the way Episcopals approach their people, they call them priests. Yeah.
He renounced his faith.
Yes, he did. You're exactly right. Yeah, and you're right too. This is very atheistic. There's nothing godly about situation ethics, the moral relativism, or what people like to refer to as the new morality. It's just the old immorality. That's all it really is. Don't be deceived by that. Let's continue very quickly here so we don't run out of time. As I pointed out, the new morality says that laws governing morals, I mean, they're talking about objective laws of right and wrong, and ethics and all of this type of thing. They'll say things like, well, it's just making you guilty when you shouldn't feel guilty. And going back to this part of this, what was on the last, on this back cover, this review of this book, and it talks about any act, lying, premarital sex, abortion, adultery, and murder could be right. Well, then so can rape. I don't care where you stop this thing. You can't stop it. Once you board that train, it's going to end up at its logical conclusion. And that is, anything is fair game. Somebody could say, well, she deserved it. In the end analysis, she'll appreciate that happening to her. No, she won't. That's horrible. That's the mentality is atrocious. So let's continue on. Mike, would you mind reading Romans chapter 13, 8 through 10 for us? And as you're going there, just think about this. God's word shows that love can only be demonstrated by obeying an objective standard. And we know there is one objective standard. Romans 13, 8 through 10.
Don't want anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, all is summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law.
Okay, did you hear a couple of things there? In the very beginning, it says, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. Now, I also want to make a real quick comment here. For the commandments, he says, you shall not commit it. Okay, stopping right there. Remember what Paul is doing here by inspiration of the Holy Spirit. He is actually saying when he talks about commandments, you're talking about God's law. They're interchangeable. They're synonymous terms here. But notice also, has fulfilled the law. He who loves another has fulfilled the law. There is a law out there that governs love. And then at the very end that Mike read for us, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. So when you talk about this, love can only be demonstrated by obeying an objective standard of truth, right and wrong. Matthew chapter 22, let me read that one for time's sake, but Matthew chapter 22, 35 through 40. Matthew 22, 35 through 40. Then one of them, a lawyer, asking him a question, listen, testing him, that was the idea behind this, I don't think there's sincerity there, but testing him and saying, teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? And Jesus said to him, now we're talking about the commandment and the law, one and the same thing, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Mark 12, verse 30 says, add strength in there. This is the first and great commandment. The second is like unto it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments, now listen to what he says, hang the law and the prophets. Commandments and law are one and the same thing, and there is an objective standard out there. The first and great one is what? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind. What's the second one? Well, what Paul had already said, or what Paul later would say that we address first, you shall what? Love your neighbor as yourself. Those are laws. Those are commandments. So, biblical love and care for one another, care for our fellow man, is all couched in the law. Paul here speaks of the law and its fulfillment. Jesus here talks about the commandments and the law being synonymous terms. Folks, objective laws can be fulfilled. You can't fulfill vague subjectivism. It's impossible. And that's what this quote, new morality or moral relativism teaches, that everything is up for grabs. What you want to call truth is truth. What you want to say is love is love. And it doesn't really matter if it's right or not. In fact, there is in here a story that I'm thinking he probably concocted, or maybe there is some actual truth that what happened back in World War II, that it was okay for a woman to have sexual relations with a German guard so that she could get back home to her family. So just justify what you want to do. Well, that's what people are doing now. Mike brought this out this morning. People are just living together. Well, you can just justify that. Well, how do you justify that? Well, you know, this old institution of marriage and all that, it's just a piece of paper. Well, no, it isn't. It's not just a piece of paper. We've had multiple discussions about this. This is, in fact, what? A contract, covenant between God, a man, and a woman, and that settles the story. It's terrible what we're seeing out there. And so when if you hear somebody using terminology like this, rest assured, they didn't get it from the Bible. They did not get it, or as one man used to say, yeah, they got it out of the Bible, way out of the Bible, because it didn't come from God. Yes. Yes.
Because we would rather take care of an animal than our fellow man. And that's totally wrong.
Yes.
Man has been made in the image of God, not animals. However, the righteous, Proverbs 12, verse 10, regard as the life of the beast.
Yes.
And so we are called to make sure that we take care of animals, but not above humans.
Yeah. There's a thing called balance here. You know, man first, then our animals. And you know, I would never suggest that anybody mistreat an animal at all. But you're not going to believe this, but we just saw where in California, they have passed a new law that says that you cannot rope an animal.
Rope
an animal. If you're riding a horse, you cannot use spurs. In California. It's a new thing. So you're looking at it. I'll get with you in just a moment, Jamie. Now that's more important, I guess. And what we figured out, well, there'll be no more rodeos in California because calf roping, surprise, surprise. And if you're going to ride a bronc or something like that, guess what you're going to have on? And by the way, just everyday ranchers may have to rope their livestock for their good sometimes. How about this? I've got to vaccinate that cow, and the only way I'm going to get up to it, but I'm going to have to rope it and get down there and vaccinate it, right? Sometimes you got to do stuff like this. Well, you know, so it's a crazy upside down world we're living in. Yes, Jamie. Okay. Okay.
Keeping control over the predators and the prey, and so everything overgrew, and they ended up almost killing off certain animals because we took ourselves out of the equation. And a lot of times, our helping ends up hurting when we try to overstep our role as mankind.
Okay, it's a good point. That's a good observation. If there are no absolute objective laws regarding morality and ethics, really stop to think about it, there's no way to actually know if there is this thing called or known as love. You can't really understand it. You can't even know for sure that it exists. Or if it's something that you can acknowledge, it becomes so nebulous that you can't really ever locate it and obtain it. And again, Jesus would add things like, if you love me, keep my commandments. Again, love and the law are what? They coexist in what? Love, it can only exist because of law. Why? Because God is love. He is the author. He's the progenitor of it. Yes, Anna.
Different cities.
Okay.
And there might be another law of another school to not have a uniform. Well, that's not a matter of morality. That's just expediency or wisdom, however they want to do it. Or like I learned recently in Mexico, there's not a law to mandate car seats. You don't have to have car seats in Mexico, which in the United States is a huge deal. But that's not really an issue of morality. It's an issue of just wisdom or practicality. So sometimes you have laws like that, which can't change based on where you're at, but that's not the same as a law of righteousness, like a law of morality. So I think sometimes we use the word law, and we have to kind of distinguish there's laws of righteousness.
Yeah. But I am glad that you brought one thing up as our time is starting to wind down. We may go a minute over. And Peyton, do you have your hand up? Okay, let me get to you just real quickly. Here's another thing, and you brought up something in what Jamie and Autumn were talking about too. You know, man, you know, sometimes we take a little bit too much on ourselves, and we somehow have gotten the idea now that we can control the weather and the climate. We can actually do that. Our president of this United States just the other day made the comment, well, we can't control weather well yet. Well, no, never. We're never going to control the weather. That's ludicrous. Yes, Peyton. Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's an excellent point. You can push this thing back, but maybe what Joseph Fletcher's decisions came to formulate his mindset, maybe actually came from the Darwinian concept. You know, that's what got planted in his head, and it is a rejection of authority. I just don't want anybody to tell me what's right and wrong and what I ought to do and not do. From any perspective, moral or otherwise, and they sure don't want the idea of a God who created all that is to tell them what to do. Very quickly, and I'm going to run out of time here, and if I keep you a couple of minutes, I don't really mean to, but there's a couple of things I'd like to make a quick observation on. You know, when Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments, well, let me ask you something. What commandments? Some or all of them? I'm going to suggest every one of them. And does that include moral law? Well, of course not. I mean, of course. And I might ask, if it doesn't include moral law, why not? What part of moral law should be exempted, if you will? Why should it be exempted? Somehow, are we thinking that God's moral laws are lesser laws and we really don't have to deal with that? Of course not. But the new moralist, does not accept the notion that there are any absolute. That goes back to the word relative, not absolute, objective moral standards revealed by God. He does not believe that God laid down any universal laws at all for all men, all times, under every circumstance, every situation, everywhere. He does not. They do not believe that. And it's a dangerous, dangerous thing. And it's adversely impacting our society. Now, very, very quickly, I'm just going to read this and let this one soak in. because this is so powerful. In chapter 1 of Romans, verse 28 through verse 32, through the end of the chapter, just short little verse, passage here. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. They gave themselves over to what? They didn't like to retain God in their knowledge. That goes back to what Payton was talking about. They don't like authority. They're opposed to authority. Now listen, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God. Hit it again. Haters of God. Violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving. Wow. Did you hear that? So when you reject God, you can't love somebody in reality. You're really unloving. That's the truth of the matter. Unforgiving, unmerciful, who knowing the righteousness of the judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, and not only those who do the same, but also those who approve of those who practice them. Folks, that's powerful. Now, time is up. I've kept you over about 4 minutes, and I apologize for that. Do we have a dismissal prayer? Okay, Brian's got the dismissal prayer. We'll go to our Father in prayer now.